This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of a hearing on the activities of the International Necronautical Society, a co-presentation by Cabinet and Triple Canopy. The evening featured a panel comprised of Joshua Cohen, Sam Frank, Christian Lorenzen, Sina Najafi, Alexander Provan, and Sarah Resnick, interrogating Tom McCarthy and Simon Critchley of the International Necronautical Society. It took place on September 15th, 2010.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Alexander Provan. I'm the editor of Triple Canopy. Welcome to this hearing on the activities of the International Necronautical Society. Please turn off any data transmission devices, audio recorders, or cameras. We're gathered here tonight to probe the corpus of the INS and have assembled a tribunal of experts and interested parties to do so. We have Sam Frank and Sarah Resnick of Triple Canopy, Sina Najafi of Cabinet, Christian Lorenzen, and Joshua Cohen. We've also summoned General Secretary Tom McCarthy and Chief Philosopher Simon Critchley of the INS. I trust they will answer our questions and charges candidly and fully, under pain of public judgment. This summer in Berlin, Triple Canopy editors briefed local cultural producers on the INS's covert recruitment efforts in that city, part of its putative effort to, quote, map, enter, colonize, and eventually inhabit the space of death. And we warned of the uncanny resemblances between the group's doctrine and their target demographics, the aestheticizing impulses. I warned that these conditions, compounded by the INS's actions, have had the effect of turning each of us into a medium of transmission, doomed to convey no other message than that quality of our being. The same is true here in New York. That condition is not only generally accepted, but, having in certain circles achieved an aesthetic aspect, relished. And just as aesthetic and intellectual trends reproduce themselves, as we passively receive them and then actively disseminate them, the neoliberal model of society is animated by those of us who naturally reproduce and reinforce its conditions in our daily lives. We are seduced by forms of signification that signify nothing more than their own being in relation to an audience that gets it, which is to say, gets itself. For a few prevalent and profitable systems of exchange, such as art and finance, this situation is ideal. And yet it has also made us, especially those of us who consider ourselves to be producers and consumers of culture, and for whom ideas and trends are a common currency, vulnerable to the INS, which exists primarily in the bodies of those agents and vehicles that instantiate it, whether willfully or obliviously. Just as contemporary capitalism profits from the pursuit of the endlessly deferred dream of authenticity, the INS exploits its remainder, the alienation that results when society is formed as a projection of the underlying desire for the real. The INS has exploited the weaknesses I have described by working, both openly and covertly, to disseminate its pseudo-philosophy and recruit unwitting acolytes in New York, at readings, presentations, and classes at the New School, where Simon Critchley is the chair of the philosophy department, unfortunately. Most recently, McCarthy has published a novel, C, with Knopf, which we suspect to be a necronautical vehicle, unless the necronauts are themselves merely an invention of the German conglomerate's publicity wing, but more on that later. Triple Canopy has been monitoring the INS since we hosted an event here in Brooklyn with Critchley and Anthony Auerbach, chief of propaganda, in the winter of 2008. At that time, several of us had, for a while, been interested in the group, which poses as a semi-fictitious avant-garde network, and were acquainted with its research into the ontological status of death, as well as its public presentations, which take the form of interrogations of fashionable artists and intellectuals, briefings on the history of transmission and encryption, etc. While no full record of the event exists, we have scant evidence that the briefing even took place. The recollections of those who claim to have been in attendance suggest that Auerbach and Critchley said something like this, and I quote, "Necronautical materialism insists that the dead do not come back. There are neither spirits nor revenants. The INS works to chart the space of death, to trace it in the fault lines that cross art, literature, philosophy, to tune into its frequencies in the air, to pinpoint its eruptions in the urban fabric, and ultimately to construct a craft. The INS's central concerns are marking and erasure, transit and transmission, cryptography and death. The INS spreads itself as both fiction and actuality, often blurring the two. Working between the lines in an open view, the INS inhabits and appropriates a variety of art forms and cultural moments, from the defunct avant-gardes of the last century to the political, corporate, and conspiratorial organizations they mimicked. In the months and years that followed that first encounter, even as we published accounts of INS statements, we became aware that we were being manipulated. Furthermore, we were no closer to understanding the INS, or even what necronautical means, or how the INS might navigate death, much less construct a craft that will convey us into death in such a way that we may, if not live, then at least persist, as stated in its first manifesto. Or whether this craft is an abstract concept or a real-life strategy, or how the self might be considered to have no core but exist as an experience of division, of splitting, or what all this had to do with the experience of failed transcendence. So we began to monitor the INS, even as it monitored us. We went to Berlin to investigate and ultimately publicize the INS's activities in what it has deemed the world capital of death. And now this, the apotheosis of that work. Much of the information we have about the INS, the information we believe to be a veritable representation of the group's activities, has come from a few informers who are or were once INS associates or even agents. We know that the INS is already, to use the group's own cryptic vocabulary, moving in on your networks, even as it is moving on in your networks. But knowing this does not get us any closer to determining what the INS wants, because the INS has no putative goals beyond disrupting the very sort of experience you have gathered here to enjoy, if only by disingenuously simulating it. Which explains why we have summoned Critchley and McCarthy here today. Mr. McCarthy, Mr. Critchley, please approach the box. Gentlemen, thank you for coming. I hope you're comfortable. Never mind. First, for the benefit of the audience, I'd like to ask you to clarify a few of your past statements. What does it mean to take the side of things or let matter matter? In what sense are we individuals rather than individuals? And what does it mean to be a semi-fictitious avant-garde group?
Could you repeat the questions?
I will once. What does it mean to take the side of things or to let matter matter? Let's start there.
The taking the side of things thing came from the first report, which was delivered in the General Secretary's first report to the first committee, which was delivered in 2001, I believe. And that itself had come out of a series of the type of interrogations that you were describing a moment ago when fashionable artists and intellectuals were called forward to give an account of themselves, and then their kind of testimony was analyzed and interpreted. And out of that, yeah, I guess this kind of doctrine of necronautical materialism emerged, and its main heroes, if you like, were figures like Francis Ponge, the poet, or Wallace Stevens, for whom, or in fact, I guess William Carlos Williams, but you know, for whom there is no poetry but in things, no spirit but in things. And what emerged, I guess, was a kind of anti-idealist, anti-spiritualist kind of position or dogma, if you like, which later was named necronautical materialism, either by us or by the press, or by the press at our suggestion. I can't remember which. Does that answer your question?
Can I ask a follow-up?
Yes.
Which ideas do you fear most if you're against them? What are the most threatening?
It's not about ideas per se. I mean, maybe Simon is best equipped to answer this. There's a tendency in culture.
Excuse me. Could we lock the doors, please? And yes, could the engineer turn up the volume, please?
There's been a tendency, there's a trajectory through the history of thought and art, culture in general in the West, which has been an abstracting, an idealist tendency. I guess it culminates in philosophy with the writing of Hegel, for whom thought happens when ideas rid themselves of their materialist kind of ballast and become pure concepts. And we see this as a kind of fascist project, ultimately, as a totalitarian project.
Unlike your own.
We see it as one that's not laced with any irony.
Unlike your own.
And against this, we'd pit a kind of, you know, a materialism. I mean, philosophically speaking, I guess, you know, the counter-Hegelian would be someone like Georges Bataille, you know, who mires spirit in the trough of base matter. But Simon's probably, like I said, he's better equipped to answer this question.
We, in the declaration on inauthenticity that was given in 2007, we contrast, maybe we look at the distinction between form and matter. And there's one tendency, let's say, for example, in the philosophical tradition, theological tradition, which is the attempt to elevate matter into form. And that tendency culminates in, let's say, forms of idealism. And that becomes, if you like, in one way, the rage of the belly-turned mind, where everything that is could be ingested and taken into the mind. So there are no things anymore. Things are simply there for the subject to imbibe them, ingest them. The other tendency, which is the tendency that we want to emphasize, is to try and let matter, to come back to your question, to try and find those points of resistance, materiality, a mark, a liquid, a spillage, a trace, ink, whatever it might be, that resists formalization, right? So, and then, if you like, we're constructing an alternative tradition with certain figures, like, you know, you mentioned Bataille, where, you know, for Bataille, it would be a question of the enjoyment of certain sovereign moments that would not be containable within a circuit of something like knowledge, which he associates with eroticism, and other phenomena. Now, and we associate that with a certain poetic tradition that you find in the late Wallace Stevens and in Ponge and in Rilke here and there, which is that poetry is not about the ingestion of things into, as it were, the mind of the poet, to some sort of romantic aesthetic, but the attempt to take the side of things, to let things speak in a way that resists comprehension. So, and that's the materialist, as it were, ethos which we're trying to follow through in some of our writings.
Is a goatee a kind of remainder?
A what?
Your goatee. Why did you not shave it today?
Yeah. No comment.
You mentioned tradition, which is an odd word to hear at a hearing like this. You have made a conscious decision to identify a Hegelian tradition that culminates.
It's not
in
a goatee. Can I just underline that, Mr.
Is it just a
not
big bald
because there's
hair?
A chin strap
not,
involved.
Yeah, exactly. There's no. There's right. There could be a goatee yeah. under certain conditions.
But because of the chin strap.
Yeah. Okay. Let's just clarify that, please, Mr. Cohen.
So if there's a conscious tradition of pure idea, and there is another tradition, let's say an inadvertent tradition of the thing. It brings me back to something that probably should lay some sort of foundation for the rest of this discussion, something that should be talked about before we continue with this interrogation, which is that you are a semi-fictitious avant-garde, which is merely calling yourselves an avant-garde decades after a viable avant-garde has ever really done anything for most people in this room is a retrogressive sort of dandy-esque prank.
Chin strap.
And so my question to you is that you, Simon, you've said, in a sense, the INS is anti-humanist, and it's also anti-post-humanist.
Yes.
And so my question is, if you're both anti-humanist and anti-post-humanist, how does the concept of tradition, especially a tradition that involves Hegel, or especially that a contrary tradition that involves poetry in things, how does that fit in with your disavowal of anti-post-humanism and humanism?
This is a question that Tom is better placed to answer. In many ways, the INS is deliberately anachronistic. We are inhabiting the form of the avant-garde group long after it has ceased to be relevant. In particular, maybe the futurist version of
that. Yeah, I might point out that all of the artists and thinkers that you referenced in your previous answers have been dead for over three decades.
Yeah, it's indeed. It's
yeah, but
indeed
a bicycle
true.
Wheel isn't interesting for Duchamp until it's broken, right? Until there's no bicycle attached to it anymore.
So Bataille isn't interesting until Bataille is broken?
Yeah.
Ah. So you've broken Bataille.
I think it was pretty broke already.
Ah.
I
mean, to begin with.
To come back to the idea of fiction, I mean, that's a kind of... It's all about fiction, right? I mean, you know, I guess a kind of conventional take on it would see fiction as the thing that's opposed to the real. You know, there's... Like that guy David Shields, there's reality and there's fiction, and reality is better than...
Please don't bring David Shields into this discussion.
Okay, no, well, I'm just bringing him in order to kind of... in order to drop him again. But, I mean, we're much more interested in the take of somebody like Ballard, right? I mean, he says in his introduction to Crash in 73 that the fiction's already there, we're surrounded by fictions. The whole world is full of... fantasies that we can, buy and enact, lifestyle, narratives, sexual personae, and so on and so on. The fiction is already there. The artist's task, he says, is to invent the real. And this is kind of much more compelling, an idea of fiction that's not set against the real, but that would somehow emerge through it or beyond it or from it. Or a kind of so this question of fiction. I mean, to call the INS a fiction. I mean, sure it is, but then what isn't? I mean, a novel is one kind of form of fiction that has a a history that has certain contingencies, and I guess the INS is another, and so is the Vatican or the.
Well, maybe the question that's most pertinent here is how that fiction is employed as a tool for recruitment. And to what end?
Well, fiction is about seduction, right? Always. And there's the question of belief and at what level one believes. And I guess recruitment would be through a kind of systematic seduction that often plays itself out in ways that we can't anticipate and wouldn't want to anticipate.
Are you seducing us now?
Well, we don't recruit. I mean, we don't actively recruit.
I've spoken with numerous people who have been approached by members of the INS specifically for the purpose of recruiting them.
We'd need to examine the evidence in each
of them. Well, I'm not about to present you with the evidence now.
Okay.
Well, let's, but take my word for it. In Berlin, I spoke with numerous people. I mean, perhaps you have a rogue in your midst, in Anthony Auerbach, him being in charge of propaganda, but it's nevertheless being done in your name.
As I recall, at the Drawing Center event, you declared all members of the audience to be members of the INS.
Always already necronauts.
But always already. The point is, we are all always already necronauts.
Therefore, so we don't need to recruit.
It's impossible to, you can't join, you can't leave.
I mean, by definition, a priori.
Well, in Berlin, they didn't understand this.
We'd like to hear you discuss your perceptions of inauthenticity. Isn't inauthenticity just a form of authenticity itself?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. If we think about the novels of the General Secretary, in particular, Remainder, there is a sort of, I mean, what the hero of Remainder suffers from is a certain fantasy of authenticity. The world is inauthentic. The world is felt to be unreal. And what the hero is attempting to achieve is a sort of self-coincidence of a kind through the procedure of reenactment, right? Through the reenactment of a life world which we're led to believe was the world that existed prior to the accident, of which he remembers very little, almost nothing. Whether indeed it was a reenactment of that world, we don't know. There's no evidential basis for that. So the fantasy of authenticity is a fantasy of self-coincidence. There's that idea. And that produces in the hero of Remainder sort of a tingling, right? A tingling quality, those moments where he's sort of transfixed in a sort of almost mystical state where he feels an identity with what's happening. And then that's played out progressively in more and more exaggerated ways in the novel. So authenticity would be that fantasy of self-coincidence. It would also be the fantasy of self-coincidence through death. Right? So if we think about another hugely important source for us is Hölderlin. And Hölderlin's, for example, Death of Empedocles. And what interests Hölderlin in Empedocles is that Empedocles underwent, Empedocles was seduced by the hubris of authenticity in the belief that he could identify with the god, become the god at that moment. And then the death of Empedocles, the tragedy of Empedocles, is what happens after the fact. So authenticity has that particular idea of, you know, self-coincidence, autarky, self-legitimation, self-origination. And what we're trying to do in our various means is to destabilize that. That produces, or one of the concepts that we come up with to try and name that is originary inauthenticity or dividualism. Is that, as you ask in your question, another form of authenticity? No, it's not authenticity in that sense of self-coincidence, but it is a sense, it is a possibility of being human that is, on our view, preferred.
And yet, if I might ask about the individual before us, McCarthy Critchley, Critchley McCarthy, and its own fantasy of authenticity. McCarthy was formerly a novelist. He's recruited a philosopher. He's now more than a novelist, therefore an authentic novelist, one of our most authentic novelists, one of our stars. Critchley, formerly a philosopher of so-called, or I don't, he was in England, now he's in New York. He came to New York.
He was in a rock band.
He was so-called, and now he's in New York. He's found himself an artist, and now he's more than a philosopher, therefore the chair of a philosophy department. Now, if this is not authenticity achieved through fantasy, I don't know what is. Sirs, or might I say sir? McCritchley Carthy.
Are you?
Christy McCarthy.
U.S. citizens?
This is a...
Are you U.S. citizens, you two? What citizenship do you hold?
I've got an NSK stamp in my passport.
You have an NSK passport?
You should know, speaking to the death of Empedocles, that these are the shoes that were spit by the volcano into which he jumped.
He was wearing bronze slippers.
Well, in a former life.
It was close.
In an interview that inauthentic.
It was a good try.
Can I come back? Enough of the slapstick, guys, right? Let me come back to this point of Sam Frank. I mean, Plato expels the poets, right? That's how the Republic of philosophy is formed, by an expulsion of that grit. Plato says, when the poet comes, we'll deck them in flowers, give them blowjobs, whatever the fuck, and then kick them out, you know, because there is no room for that. It must be excluded. And I guess conversely, so therefore, you know, literature then would be the supplement of philosophy. It's the thing that it's expelled in order to complete itself, and therefore the thing that it lacks. And then to kind of appropriate or that supplement would is necessary. And this is like the whole project of someone like Derrida, who, you know, we massively admire and would, you know, see as a kind of necron or avant la lettre or whatever.
He's dead now.
Oh, he's dead. So, you know, but no, to answer the kind of, you know, the what I think was a kind of serious question there, before the shoes started slamming and so on, each would supplement the other, but does that make it authentic? How is that some kind of a relapse into some fantasy of authenticity? Surely is it not more of a fantasy of kind of eternal breachedness or something, or amorphousness?
If I might contradict you, Tom, it's an interesting thought, isn't it? Because it's, you know, it's perverse that we, an anti-novelist and an anti-philosopher, end up as a novelist and a philosopher. So, as it were, we've unwittingly found ourselves, we've submitted ourselves to a fantasy of authenticity. It's peculiar. It wasn't willed.
Well,
it
weren't the willed. First Western philosophers, for instance, Heraclitus, all poets?
No, they were physiologists.
But didn't they write in verse?
No. There was some. We don't know. We have, you know, the Deals fragments. We have bits and pieces. But basically, they were concerned with the study of materiality of nature. In the case of, you know, Empedocles, Heraclitus, Thales, and the rest, there's a concern with materiality as a principle, and how to find a concept which can name that, you know? That's water in Thales, logos in Heraclitus. So there then becomes a question of to go back to what Tom was saying, what's peculiar is that in Book 10 of Plato's Republic, Socrates, in the form of an indirect form of communication. Theatre is the opponent. Theatre is the rival. That has to be excluded. Right? And it's excluded in a theatrical discourse, that we think of as Socratic dialogue. So we have that problem. And in that dialogue, we have the exclusion of poetry, in particular the tragic poets, and what goes together with that is the addendum that if those poets can make an apology, either in verse or in prose, of what they do, they might be readmitted back into the city. So there is this, you know, ancient quarrel between philosophy and poetry. Now, we are very much concerned with that, but I mean, it's the in many ways more important to what we do, I think, would be some sort of thinking through of the logic of tragedy. You know, would be a although, you know, we've been critical of tragedy, that there's a sense in which something is articulated there which is enormously powerful, which I'd be happy to talk about at some later point.
Critchley, you've said,
yes,
the art world is the intelligent place where literature is being read and discussed.
Oh,
I thought that was
Are we
me.
In the art world right now?
That was Tom. Mr. McCarthy. Sure.
Mr. McCarthy, I'm sorry. And are we in the art world right now? And is this an intelligent discussion? And for both of you, did you choose the art world, or did the art world choose you?
That's a good question.
When the INS started, we took the position that this is not art. We took that position. It was playing out immediately, kind of within the art world. That seemed to be the first adopter of the INS. But it started, you know, it started in 99 at a time when basically every schmuck wanted to be considered as an artist. I mean, everyone was jumping on the boat. Political activists were now artists. You know, writers, critics were now artists. That this is, and so I thought it'd be interesting to kind of, we thought it would be interesting to take the exact, to head in the other direction, and to take the position that this was not art, even as we were being hosted by art institutions and kind of fueled by the whatever the discursive networks of art and its presses and so on. And then when it came to setting up the first INS broadcasting unit, which was a pretty ambitious project, and it was a kind of William Burroughs type fantasy of viral transmission. We had a radio station, and it cost about $60,000, and we needed to apply for funding, and the only place that was going to fund that was the Arts Council of England. So we had to take the position, actually, this is art. So it's been very strategic all along. I mean, I can't imagine an environment outside of art where you could get, you know, you could set up a 50 grand radio station and have 40 people cutting up newspapers and transmitting it over the airwaves for no discernible benefit to society.
Marketing or advertising.
Yeah, but then
the two have more or less merged.
Sorry?
The two have merged to some degree.
Yeah, sure. Okay. But then there would still have to be some kind of whatever product or some.
So how did you envision the product of that project?
The product was a process. It's always the product is always a process.
Input output.
It's input output. It's always about transmission, not to an end or to an endpoint, but to you know, as a kind of perpetual, unfulfillable kind of process. But then the interest, you know, the point then becomes, well, you know, does this... There's been a tendency to treat the INS as an art project, as a conceptual art project, which is, you know, which is both to be welcomed and resisted, ultimately. The idea that art could just kind of explain this whole process is a bit wide of the mark. I mean, it's you know, if we're a kind of slug, that's a good shell to move forwards in, but it's not the... It's not the end point at all. There is a project, there is a trajectory, and that is bigger than art.
And the inhabitation of the art world is accidental. I mean, it's a series of accidents that happened over a period of time. I mean, there's sort of an interesting question here, which is the, why is it? I agree with your question. Why is it that something like literature, you know, has become... it's possible to articulate that in an artistic context in a way that's actually more powerful than in a traditional literary context. Certainly, you know, where we're from in Britain, where there was a sort of middlebrow takeover, and then similarly, one would imagine or hope that universities or academic spaces were places where there could be thinking. In particular, thinking, say, about something like literature, this is evidently not the case. Right? The last thing people want to do is to think about the experience of literature. They want the experience of literature to be closed down.
Well,
if I can
quote a recent New York Times review of C, it says that C, the worst thing about C is that it fails to engage the reader on the most basic level as a narrative or text. And the writer of this review, Michiko Kutani, compares the book to Ian McEwan's masterpiece, Atonement. But unlike McEwan's masterpiece, she says, C neither addresses larger questions about love and innocence and evil, nor unfolds into a searching examination of the consequences of art. Instead, the book contains repeated references to radio transmissions and coded messages sent over the airwaves, which are apparently meant to signal the world's entry into a new age of technology and to underscore themes about the difficulties of communication and perception and the elusive nature of reality, which, again, fails to engage the reader on the most basic level as a narrative or text, which is what happens when you move from the art context to the publishing context, I assume, or what's happened to you in this particular instance, but maybe not generally. Has that been an edifying experience for you?
And is C art or is it literature?
There is a dominant kind of, let's call it an ideology. I don't think it's too strong to call it an ideology within culture, within publishing, but within culture at large, which is a kind of sentimental humanist one, in which it's as though the world had been transformed into one giant Big Brother diary room, and we are just meant to sit in front of the camera and emote. Mm-hmm. And the absolute authenticity of that emoting is what constitutes us, or what represents us as absolutely authentic individuals. Now, this is to be resisted. It is to be shat on from a great height. It is aesthetically bad. It is politically bad. It's bad in every which way. So the question then is how does one do that? How does one articulate that? What kind of channels can one find to kind of, what networks can one find to move on in or in on in order to kind of, you know, attend to that task? And this kind of goes back to the last question. I think the borderlines between literature and art and philosophy and various other kind of practices become porous at certain points, and those are the very points at which it gets interesting, and at which these kind of more subversive, ultimately, possibilities are kind of emerge. Is that so? I can't really answer your question.
Well, let me, but if I might, if I might read poorly the first paragraph of C and ask a question. Dr. Learmont, newly appointed general practitioner for the districts of West Maysdown and New Ellery, rocks and jolts in the front seat of a trap as it descends the lightly sloping path of Versoy House. He has sore buttocks, the seats hard and uncushioned. His companion, Mr. Dean of Hudson and Dean Deliveries, Lydium and Environs since 1868, doesn't seem to feel any discomfort. His glazed eyes stare vaguely ahead. His leathery hands, reins woven through their fingers, hover just above his knees. The rattle of glass bottles and the fricker of rasp of copper wire against more copper wire rise from the trap's back and, mixing with the click and shuffle of the horse's hooves on gravel, hang undisturbed about the still September air. Above the vehicle, tall conifers rise straight and inert as columns. Higher, much further out, blackbirds whir silently beneath a concave vault of sky.
So
now my question is posed to the INS. The INS has been known, or suggested it might, purge internal enemies. Now, having purged style here, might I ask what style's crimes are?
What style's what?
What its crimes are, sir.
He's saying you've got no style.
I have no answer to that question, sorry.
I'd like to go back to the question of sentimentality. And I'd like to read part of an interview that you two gentlemen gave.
Can I just, before you,
yes.
Before Mr. Jaffe, I mean, there's a quotation from C where it said, he sees things flat, He paints things flat, objects, figures, landscapes, flat. Flat. I mean, the what the critic in the New York Times is resisting is flatness, because we expect literature to somehow.
Well, also to offer us the same self-coincidence that the main character from Remainder is seeking,
mm-hmm.
and by doing that, providing some sense of authenticity for the reader, which Mr. McCarthy has denied us in the past, and I imagine will continue to deny us. But the
peculiar thing about this is that, you know, there was something called modernism. Good Lord, was there really? There was something called modernism which, you know, yeah, sorry, go on. So.
But when you're describing this fantasy of self-coincidence, I mean, what is Don Quixote about, if not that, right? Ever since the beginning of the novel, you know, that this masterpiece of Ian McEwan thing that you were talking about, this I don't recognize this in the history of literature. Don Quixote is about a guy who cannot coincide with himself, who's stuck in a set of stuttering reenactments that are carried out in a vain kind of bid for some kind of authenticity, which he never masters, mm-hmm. in which is eternally mediated. It's a book about media, one's relation to media, and this is kind of what Hamlet's about. I mean, and of course, kind of, yeah, sure, modernism accelerates all of that and kind of brings it into focus. And I think the kind of tendency to brush that all aside and return to some kitsch, regressive, sentimental version of the 19th century novel.
Yeah, Hamlet doesn't...
It's appalling.
Hamlet never coincides with himself. Hamlet always takes up the position of somebody else. Whether it's the ghost, whether it's its mother, whether it's Ophelia, anybody. Hamlet, as it were, the cipher of modern literature in some sense. What defines Hamlet is a radical non-self-coincidence, which means that he cannot perform the one act which he's meant to perform.
He can only reenact the trauma of his father's death.
In the play called The Mousetrap, to catch the conscience of the king, which itself is enclosed within a series of conceits. I mean, so... To that extent, what we're doing is traditional.
I would like to...
I think Sina was... I interrupted Sina, sorry.
I'll come... Well, go ahead. Yeah. I wanted to go to the question of authenticity by reading a little part from an interview you gave a while ago to a gentleman called Mr. Soderstrom. Tom McCarthy says, well, I think the real question for us is the question of the subject, the question of the self. So, for example, in the heroic tradition in literature, which pits the self against death in a way that produces authenticity, you find a hero that runs into death like a fly slamming into an electric field, and which goes out in a tremendous spark of authentic apotheosis. There's a lot about that aesthetically, which is very seductive. However, we at the INS strongly reject that. Instead, we feel more seduced by the comic tradition, in which the fly can't even reach the electric field. He keeps tripping over his legs or becomes distracted by something. Dog shit, for example. So death in the comic tradition is not that of authentic self-mastery, but rather of a slippage. It's about the inability to be oneself and to become what one wants to be. And we think that kind of traditional logic is much more rich and fruitful than the other one. So my question to you is a simple one. What happens to the flies that go past the electric field? What happens to the flies that actually do not get zapped, do make it through all the way? Is there no place for those flies in literature? Are they not heroes?
They're flies.
They went past the electric field. They were neither comic nor tragic.
So you say.
That's not a possibility for literature.
Can you think of an example?
There should be examples.
Sorry?
There should be examples.
Gregor Samsa kind of just gets over it.
For example?
Gets a few more sets of shoes.
That's what this country's been built on. Knowing that we can go
get
through the
it,
force
man.
Field. We're not going to get zapped, and we're not going to get distracted by dog shit. We're going to get through the force field.
And get a retirement home in Florida.
Yes.
I mean,
it's what has made this country great, believing that.
Maybe Updike's rabbit? Would he be like the fly that doesn't turn into... Seriously. It's interesting what you're saying. I'm just trying to think of an example from literature.
Is this why literature should be banned?
Sorry?
Is this why literature should be banned? Because it offers only two possibilities, two kinds of failures, and that's our choice. Success has no place in this literature of philosophy.
I can't imagine literature which is not about failure. I cannot imagine what that literature could be. I can only imagine
point.
It would be kind of bad. I mean...
You can only imagine it's sentimental.
Yeah. As self-help. Hey, funnily enough, I was looking in C, the Knopf edition, and they have these Library of Congress categories. And the first one was literature technology, and the second one was psychology self-actualization.
They know something about you don't. That's our Library of Congress.
I guess they didn't have a self-disintegration category.
No.
I don't know how they do this, if they just scan it in and it kind of...
Actually, I hate to tell it to you, but Knopf chose those categories.
No, I asked them. They didn't. They flatly deny it.
Yeah. Is there anybody from Knopf here tonight?
Where is the Knopf person? Oh, no.
We didn't have anything to do with it.
Will you come forward?
As long as there is a Knopf representative in the room, I have two questions that only the intellectually irresponsible will consider to be linked. Firstly, I want to go back to the hyphenated prefix semi in your mission statement, a semi-fictitious avant-garde organization. I believe it's merely a hedge. Isn't the INS, in fact, entirely fictional, though not as a, quote, secret research society, but rather as a quite brazen smokescreen enabling the more effective dissemination of your individual projects? Mr. McCarthy, your novels. Mr. Critchley, your philosophy. And secondly, and again, unlinked, haven't the space and indeed the state of death, because I hope to talk about death in this question, been usurped only recently by this rogue entity called the Internet, with which the INS openly and actively collaborates? Now that the Internet has, in a sense, gone eternally public, can it be said that death itself has died?
The first question, there are terraced houses, there are detached houses, and there are semi-detached houses. And the semi-detached houses have outside the front garden a hedge. The second question... The internet is a technique of surveillance, which the INS has a partial relationship to, and which we are considering systematically withdrawing from.
Death and media have always been intimately linked. Right? I mean, Freud says that that all technology is a kind of prosthesis, right? It extends, the camera's an artificial eye, the telephone's an artificial ear, and so on. It extends us, our subjectivity, through space infinitely, and at the same time, it castrates us, it amputates us. That's what all of David Lynch's films are about, right? I mean, it marks us as simultaneously more than and less than. For the psychoanalyst... and critic Lawrence Rickels, riffing off Freud, he says that every point of contact between a body and its media extension marks the site of a burial. So all media is death. It is a crypt and a site of encrypted transmission. With older media like radio and vinyl, it kind of rarefies an absence, right? Your voice is there, but you're not. I guess the internet kind of continues that tradition, but in a way it almost inverts it, right? It's all about revenants, but it's about stuff never going away. Every brushstroke you made is still there and eternally trackable and retrievable. It's why all these pop stars keep getting arrested for paedophilia, because when they take their computers to be fixed. This eternal, this kind of over... Derrida has this phrase when he's talking about Joyce, hypermnesia, like the opposite of amnesia. Everything is all there, but that's a kind of psychosis too, and it's a kind of haunting. The internet kind of fascinates us and lots of... One INS project in particular, when we kind of hacked into, or didn't hack, we infiltrated the BBC. It was their website. I mean, we had an agent on the inside who was inserting INS propaganda into the source code.
Hack is something you do with an axe, just like a hedge is something outside of a semi-detached house.
Okay, we didn't hack. I don't know what the word for it would be. Does that answer your question? So I'm rambling a bit.
Secretary McCarthy. You just used the word kitsch in application to Ian McEwan's masterpiece. Yeah. You called it...
I can't...
it kitsch, and then you said appalling.
I don't know whether you did.
I don't think I did.
You did. I wrote it down.
That must be true, then.
You did it offhandedly.
I can't have... I have not read Ian McEwan's masterpiece or any of his other master pies.
You were referring to a kitsch 19th century novel. Kitsch imitation of a 19th century novel.
I was not referring to Ian McEwan. I was talking more generically.
Generically, okay. Yeah. Fair enough, but you implied...
Did I?
...that he belonged to that category.
I think you inferred it.
That was the only specific novel you were talking about within... that set of remarks.
It was the pie you put on the table. But what's your point?
You implied that the authors of such novels revivified kitsch 19th century novels being written today.
No, I have a lot of time for the 19th century novel. I think the problem is a kind of a kitsch version of the 19th century novel.
Right.
Dickens is quite good stuff, man.
But...
It's weirdly post-modern.
I understand. We're talking about the same thing. That's what I meant. It would seem that the practitioners of such novel writing, wouldn't consider their work to be kitsch. Do you think that's true?
I'm certain that's true, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is...
It's probably not a category in the Library of Congress, either.
Is it possible, then... to write a kitsch or create a kitsch masterpiece, and is it possible to do so either consciously or unconsciously?
Isn't it, maybe that's what Warhol's whole project was about in some way. Mm-hmm.
But he was doing it consciously, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What about unconsciously?
Unconscious kitsch.
Masterpiece.
Unconscious and kitsch masterpiece.
Unconscious kitsch genius, yeah. Mm-hmm.
No comment.
I think maybe we'll take one more question from the tribunal, and then we'll go to the audience for just a few minutes, and then the hearing will come to an end.
You have, Critchley, I believe you have stated, death reveals the radical inauthenticity that's constitutive of the self. So how exactly does it reveal it to us if it also kills us?
The way the claim is structured is that, I mean, going back to this idea of authenticity as a fantasy of self-coincidence, right, which is fantasized in particular in relationship to death. I mean, going back to something that Sina said about comedy, I mean, if in tragedy one dies, in comedy one lives and is living more tragic
So is comedy more tragic than tragedy? Right? In tragedy,
it's,
there
it's
is
tragedy plus time.
Yes, as Woody Allen says, the idea of death as such would be, you know, that in relationship to which the self is structured authentically, and the locus classicus for this in 20th century thought would be someone like Heidegger. Right? What we're trying to push at against that is an idea of dying, whereby if the fantasy of authenticity is a fantasy of self-coincidence in the moment of death, then what we call originary inauthenticity would be the inability to achieve such a fantasy. And that would be articulated comically, right? In comedy, one does not die, one lives, and the whole thing carries on.
Like Wile E. Coyote, right?
Yeah,
Wile
E. Coyote.
Throwing himself up again and again and again.
Or in Beckett. I mean, Beckett's, you know, tragicomedy. Then the genre of tragicomedy would be where the characters, I mean, Vladimir and Estragon, want to submit to the fantasy of authenticity, to hang themselves from a tree, and that's what they can't do, and that's what's funny. Right? Let's go. They do not move, right? The way both Act 1 and Act 2 finish, and one is a repetition of the other. So that the inauthenticity is what's inauthentic is the fact that my dying is something that I cannot comprehend or contain. It's a movement of, if you like, non-comprehensible self-dissolution, a process of atrophying. So that the characters that interest us, say, for example, our interest in Beckett would turn on that. These characters, in a sense, that are not capable of tragedy, not capable of death, and instead we see them undergoing a process of dying which is not completed. Right? That's our necronaut, as it were.
One final question pertaining to death. More is real than is possible. This was a dominant dictum of the 20th century. More
is
real than is possible. By claiming death as an investigatable realm, you seek to go beyond this principle, but instead I believe you fail it and reverse it. You say, the INS says, more is possible than is real. I urge you to defend, after a century of wars and genocides, this backward glance, this slide into fantasy and farce.
Maurice Blanchot has this line in
L'Astre de la Mort?
No, it's not that one. It's in The Writing of the Disaster,
yeah.
Right? Where he says, if death is the real and the real is impossible, then we're beginning to approach the thought of the impossibility of death.
Right.
Right? If death is the real and the real is not possible, then maybe death is not possible either. I mean, I don't recognize your accusation. I mean, I think we're trying to kind of unpick or enact somehow the implications of that kind of statement that Blanchot makes, but I don't see the kind of regressive slide into farce that you're talking about.
Well, then I think we've gotten somewhere.
Good.
Tea party.
Let me tell you, there's an aisle between us. It's kind of like a black river running between us, deep black, deep river. And over on your side, I don't know what you're talking about. But on my side, I can take a lot of blame for this necro tautological stuff y'all talk about. Now, I don't think that's right. What do you do? You're giving it your fancy magazines, you work with fancy universities over there. What we do on my side of the aisle, we like slaughter hogs.
Sir, where is the aisle?
And we sell the aisle. You're going to come to it, son. You're going to come to it. Out of the black river.
How can the aisle also be a black river? They produce a black river, which produces an aisle.
They got no much more money in it. It's
Well, I maybe Mr. Critchley, you could answer this. Having said that, the philosopher looks death in the face and has the strength to say that it is nothing, implying that that is the Black River thing is perhaps to some degree the responsibility of the philosopher. But going back to what Mr. McCarthy said, comparing death to the real, then maybe in fact the philosopher looks the real in the face and has the strength to say it is nothing as well, which may or may not also relate to this. Exactly, evasions.
But if the pig is dead, can you eat it?
But who is responsible for coming up to with the solution to this, and does the philosopher bear any responsibility in your view?
Bad times are coming. Times during which no one is safe except those who inhabit graves. And I believe the questioner works at Princeton University. So I was rather confused by his intervention. A thing just to say, can I just say this? And this is something that Tom and I struggle with. The INS is immensely serious. We're very serious about this. We use certain conceits and vehicles to make certain things happen. But this isn't a joke. No, but tragedy isn't a joke either. Comedy isn't a joke either. I mean,
it's the same as the question of fiction. I mean, if fiction is not that which is set against...
Well,
these people seem to be dying. You seem to be living. I don't see death in your face.
Thank you, sir.
We are flat modernist characters, and you are very well fleshed.
why are you more amusing? Why are you so serious? Why are you so boring?
Oh. I think
we're inauthentic actors and thereby attain some level of authenticity.
I think boredom is our obligation at this point. If we're boring you, then we might be doing something interesting. I think you deserve to be bored. No relationship between boredom and death. I mean, we set out this evening precisely to bore you.
We could say that the evening fails to engage the audience on the most basic level as a narrative or text. Not to be funny. Do we have another question over here?
Red.
Do you want to expand on that? Like how we have nothing. How does it?
Could you recount the plot of Death Wish, perhaps?
Fodder for the previous questioner's claims that we were being evasive.
And so I feel like he is in fact your first colonist. He is there waiting for you to arrive.
I wonder if the German title for that movie is like Todeswang.
Todeswunsch.
I believe the German title is Death Wish. Zwei.
Zwei, yeah. This time it's serious, yeah.
Any other questions?
Ah. That's a good good one.
Okay.
Loving us.
Our view is that authenticity is morally irresponsible. And therefore, there's a direct correlation between inauthenticity and moral responsibility. The ethical subject, in a certain sense, could be defined as a subject who is who doesn't coincide with himself or herself, right? So if you like, the condition of possibility for moral responsibility would be an inauthentic subject, and the delusion that vast areas of culture suffer from is the delusion of an authenticity which actually ruins any conception of moral responsibility. So again, to come back to, I mean, this is the, you know, to try and wrest this from the grip of farce. I mean, what's driving this is an enormously serious idea of moral responsibility, which cannot be reduced to some idea of an autonomous subject, but a subject that's divided against itself in relationship to a question of trauma, which figures throughout Tom's novels and stuff that I do as well, or the experience of the disaster as that which would structure a self. And so, you know, so in a sense, what's driving... The INS in that sense is a hyper-moral project.
And to come back to Beckett as well, I mean, like at the end of Godot, after all that failure to self-coincide and so on, Vladimir says, like, the best line ever written by any writer ever, which is simply, was I sleeping while the others suffered? Am I sleeping now? Tomorrow when I wake or think I do, what shall I say of today? That we did this, we did that, but in all that, what truth will there be? I mean, that's an ethical moment, right? That's the moment of where literature becomes ethics through a recognition of a comic recognition of complete failure and complete inauthenticity, and it's brilliant.
Is inauthenticity a humanism?
No, I think but it's nah. This. Yeah. No, I think there's this whole tendency, like, you know, people... Like when Derrida died, that arsehole French president, what was his name, Chirac, called him a humanist. I doubt he'd read a word of his, but he said Derrida was a great humanist. And there's the same thing with Levinas. You know, Levinas, all of whose thought is about trauma, violence, being ruptured and taken hostage and tortured by the other. That's the basis of ethics. Then there's this whole kind of attempt to kind of recuperate him as a humanist somehow, which seems kind of perverse. I don't think it works.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, to go back to something that Sarah Resnick was saying about we're anti-humanist and anti-post-humanist, right? So there's an anti-humanism which turns on the idea of a certain stable, autonomous, I don't know, bourgeois idea of the subject, and we're anti-post-humanist in the sense in which we do not want to submit to a fantasy of exceeding the human condition, you know, whether that's through forms of post-human realities achieved through, new forms of existence, intelligence, cyber, blah, blah, blah. We, in that sense, there's... being a human, we're human and that's nothing to be proud of. We're human and that's nothing to be proud of. So in that sense, if there is a sort of residual assertion of the human in the INS, it's a sort of... If we even had the condition of animality, that would be rather nice. You know, there's a sense in which humanity, understood in terms of this... non-self-coincidence and inauthenticity is a humanity that's nothing to be proud of. I guess that's the thought.
Mr. McCarthy has said that post-humanism is just an extension of humanism. It's humanism 2.0.
Yeah.
And he went on to say that technology is automatically a critique of humanism because it shows that we are not self-efficient, but rather networked. And my question is an ethical network possible if a network is just a medium of transmission?
And do we want to actually impute ethics to a network and sort of divest ourselves of responsibility? And is that not, in fact, anti-humanist, which is immoral and non-ethical?
No, if we're plugged into the network, if we're interrupted by its transmissions, by its interference, then that's
not. What do you mean by interrupted by its transmissions and interference?
If the network is going through us, if we're plugged into Levinas says we have one finger in the machine always. I mean, stuck in the machine, caught in the machine, I think is the term he uses. I mean, if one is connected, one can't deny a relation, right?
So one's caught flesh in the machine determines the ethos of the network?
One's caught subjectivity in the machine, yeah.
See, machine, well, let me take an example. I mean, it's an example that this might help, it might not.
And we should wrap this up soon.
Yeah. The Oresteia, Aeschylus. It's very important to both of us. What is origin of... We're not very keen on theatre, but there we are. The Oresteia begins with a network, right? There is a situation where there's an interruption by a media network, a series of beacons that...
Transmit a message.
Yeah, transmit a message from Troy to Argos, and which interrupt a sequence and bring about a series of repetitions, acts of vengeance, and different claims to justice. The space of literature in that sense is articulated around this sort of network figures. And that's something we're trying to, Tom is trying to plot in different ways. But in many ways, this is something one can find, the Greeks pondering 2.5 millennia ago, right? With their chariots and their mechanes and these weird devices that, as it were already prosthetic supplements to the theatrical act and which made the whole thing possible.
Just one more about humanism before we move on. There's obviously avant-gardes are known for suppressing early texts by their members that don't fulfill the tenets, the lay tenets, the scientific tenets, or so on. And we hear about the young Marx, the humanist Marx, for example, before he became the scientific Marx, and so on. I think many people in this room believe that McCarthy has written two novels, Remainder and C. But there's a novel that I believe he began before Remainder, finished after Remainder, which I haven't read. It's been suppressed in America. Knopf has suppressed it, perhaps. And it's called Men in Space. And not having read it, I don't know what it consists of, what it's about. I can only interpret its title. If the Necronauts are about the space of death, this is Men in Space. Might this not be your humanist novel that is being suppressed, in fact? And where is this novel?
It's coming to a bookstore near you in March 2011. $11.99.
And you can buy Mr. McCarthy's recent novel, C, at a table over there.
I don't know. I didn't bring it.
Men in Space is about men in space. It's about a world of debris and detritus, and a world where, in a sense, there might be certain struggles for authenticity and meaning, and which are sadly undermined. So in that sense, it's not... To defend my general secretary, it's in complete continuity with necronautical doctrine rather than being an exception. And I could provide more evidence.
Revisions after the fact are fair practice, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually going to be called, the American title is actually Space in Men.
I think we'll conclude the hearing there.